Post-secular thought refutes an assumption so many of us take for granted, namely that we live in a secular age. But what does it mean to be post-secular? Does it mean that we are no longer secular beings? Does it mean that we're now living in a different era? Did a truly post-secular era ever really come of age? Or does the post-secular imply a different set of questions altogether? Does it involve a different way of imagining who we are?
Human beings are constantly thinking about the paradoxical intersection of the immanent, the material, the calculable, the finite, with all of these things that seem to sacramentally, representationally point beyond that immanence toward what is the very ground of being.
I'm speaking today with Lori Branch, Associate Professor of English at the University of Iowa, and one of the great interpreters of what it means to live in a post-secular way. I'm Matthew Wickman, Founding Director of the BYU Humanities Center, and the host of this podcast. Lori Branch and I have been friends for a few years now. She's been a guest at BYU on several occasions as a keynote speaker. She has a recurring role as a guest teacher in a seminar for graduate students. And post-pandemic, later this year, we hope, you know, knock on wood, will be a guest at a BYU Humanities Center symposium on the subject of belief. I'll add that I was also a part of a 2019 NEH seminar organized by Lori and Mark Knight on the subject of religion, secularism, and the novel. Lori is a highly respected scholar on the subject of literature and religion. So when we had the idea for this new podcast, Lori struck me as the perfect inaugural guest. Thank you, Lori, for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here with you virtually, Matt, and have this conversation.
Yeah, fantastic. Grateful we can have it virtually, actually. This is better than conference call. We're on Zoom right now is how we're talking. So, Lori, during your first visit to BYU in November 2015, when you were a keynote speaker at a conference that we were holding, you and I got into a lengthy conversation in the Cougar Eat, the student cafeteria, about the subject of faith, right? As this podcast is titled Faith and Imagination, I'm wondering if we can talk for a moment about faith. And I'm wondering how you would define faith and how faith informs your work as a teacher and scholar.
Sure. You know, I want to say at the beginning, I love the title for your podcast, this, you know, Faith and Imagination.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, faith is, of course, trust in the Lord. Faith is hope for things in the future, like it tells us in the Epistle to the Hebrews. But there is something inherently imaginative about faith. Right. I mean, it says in Hebrews, I was rereading Hebrews this morning, thinking about your thinking about this topic. And, you know, when it talks about how all the great patriarchs and matriarchs of the faith, you know, they died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them and embraced them and, you know, and lived their lives.
Nice.
And, you know, that is that seeing afar off the things that we hope for, right? That for me is really the way that faith is imaginative. Like when the Lord tells you, I'm going to, you know, you need to leave your home and go to this other land, or I know you're old, but you're going to have a child. And obviously, you know cognitively what that is or the place that you're being led, but you're also seeing it from afar off. And that is an imagination of what it is. And so that act of following that leading of God, that really trusting, you know, that this is a good, that God is good, that he is going to lead you in a way, that God rewards those who earnestly seek him, like it also says in Hebrews. You know, that is imaginative. And so I just think this is a wonderful topic, for us to like bring that together, Matt. You know, this our scholarly thinkings about imagination and then also faith, because really, truly, I think there's a lot of deep human overlap on that topic.
That's fantastic. That's a great way to describe why we named this what we did. You did a better job of it than I have done, actually, in talking about that. That was wonderful. Thank you. So how does that, you're a person of faith, obviously. You're also a university professor. How do you bring those things together in your own imagination of your work?
Yeah. Now, well, I mean, I guess I would want to divide it kind of, it's not divided, but into teaching and scholarship, you know, I mean, in a scholarly vein, right? Growing up intellectually, whenever I grew up, I think like you in grad school in the 90s and the things that we were thinking about at that time, right? A lot of that was a thinking about knowledge and epistemology. I mean, how do we know what we know? Philosophy had gone through the linguistic turn. And that thinking about knowledge and uncertainty, right, it was really a place to think about faith. And so it's always seemed to me that in literature, and you know, in our great literature of the world, I think about Tintern Abbey by William Wordsworth, where he's talking about all the things he believes about life and the cosmos and the beauty of nature and God's involvement in it. And then he asks himself the question, if this be but a vain belief.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes on to consider from there, right? I mean, he's really thinking hard about the status of belief in terms of like knowledge of the world. And so the poetry itself and the theoretical concerns that I was studying have always seemed to me to be circling around these issues of faith and knowledge, of uncertainty and doubt and hope and trust and belief. And so for me, that connection has always been really natural on the intellectual end, even though it seemed to me then that all of that so many of our scholarly conversations were skirting that religiousness. I always wanted to call it religiousness, but what I learned to call it after I did more research and thinking about secularism was that it's really just about imagining the world and human life in a way that doesn't cordon off everything related to uncertainty and belief to some religious, private, individual hinterland. You know, I mean, that says, no, that's a part of our whole human functioning, our whole like human experience. So, I mean, that's a very nutshell kind of fortune cookie version, but it seemed to me that these things were naturally integrated and that scholarship, the way it was often functioning, was artificially separating them out. And like so many things I would read, whether it was, you know, Robinson Crusoe or Jean-François Lyotard or whatever it was, or Derrida, you know, I was like, this is so religious. That's what I was thinking inside my graduate school self, you know, like, why is no one talking about, you know, the faith kind of dimension of this. And so then later I had to learn to see that's the critical act that's happening, is this division of the secular off from the religious. And then I wanted to be critical and think in an intellectual way about that.
Yeah, good.
So that's kind of the intellectual end of it. But then, you know, I mean, on the personal end of it, like teaching is such a joy. It's such a gift. It's such a privilege. I think it's like the fountain of youth besides all that. I mean, to have your whole career be where you're dealing with 18 to 28 year olds, if you want to count in the PhD students, you know, in that whole range, you know, I mean, it's just such a fountain of life and seeking and continual engagement, because they're changing all the time and that keeps you on your toes. I mean, the students who come to you are changing, but also, I mean, you know, they're real human beings. There's no ivory tower in that sense of like you're isolated by yourself. If you're teaching, you know, you're always engaged with these young people, and your faith meets your work every day, because one, you're extending to them the benefit of the doubt. But also, I mean, if you're a Christian, you're praying for those students. I mean, that seems really, maybe I'm saying that too directly or something, but you know, I mean, a Christian, you can read the novels of Marilynne Robinson. I'm thinking about like secular people who might be listening to this. You know, you can read the novels of secular Robinson. This is what religious people do. I mean, we go through our life and we're asking God's blessing. We believe that the whole world is made by a good creator and who loves us, and that we go through troubles and difficulties, certainly, but whoever you encounter, you're trying to encounter them in a spirit of love, and you're trying to call down God's blessing on them. And so this is a normal part. So of course, if you're teaching, or you're just in committee work with your colleagues or whatever you're doing for a Christian person anyway, a Christian religious person, this is what you're doing, you know? So there is automatically this really rich connection and being in the classroom with these young people, they're exploring so many ideas and going through so much stress. How could you be a person of faith and then think that that situation weren't connected to that? Of course it's connected.
Yeah, it's great. Just yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was talking with a student over a Zoom call, you know, as we do these days during a pandemic. And there's a question, I give the students a questionnaire before the semester, and I meet with them to have them respond to the questions. And the last question I ask is, what's a question you wish I were asking that I didn't ask you? And this student wrote down, asked me what I mean by faith. So I said, okay. So we got to the last question. I said, okay, so what do you mean by faith? And he said, well, he said, for me at this stage of my life, you know, he's applying to graduate schools right now. He's not quite sure what his future is. He changed majors from like mathematics to English. He said, for me, faith is an actionable hope. And it's a hope on which you can act in a meaningful way. And he said, at this stage of my life, so many of the things that I do are leaps of faith. And they're not just a belief in God, but a belief in myself. Can I do this? A belief in institutions. Will these institutions be here in 3 years? A belief in the country. Well, I mean, that this idea of an actionable hope and he's talking, I mean, this is a religious person who understands the religious definitions of faith, the doctrinal aspects of faith, the theological. But he was really trying to abstract from that and say, well, what in my life do I do that's not belonging to the larger dynamics of faith? Such that for him, religion is a way to conceptualize how he actually lives in the world, even in things that are otherwise very secular, you know? And I found that to be an interesting way to reflect on this also, this actionable hope, including a sense of confidence that these things that we want to be there will in fact and are there.
Yeah. I love that. It's because it's really then faith is predicated on our existence and time, you know, and this, the life in this age, you know, not the age to come that the scripture talks about, but this age, because then we are in the flow of time. And so that actionable, you are always having to look to that age to come, the age outside of our linear time. And yeah, I love that actionable hope.
Yeah. I thought it was nice. I thought I'd pass that along. So. Now, you are a respected scholar and critic of the post-secular, right? A body of thought that takes a renewed interest in religion. And you've written some very important work and hosted workshops and given lectures and taught classes. And you're a very important figure in this field and in spelling out what post-secular thought is. And you've written a manifesto about the post-secular. And I'd like to review a couple of the tenets of post-secular studies as you define it, right? You list kind of, I guess, seven different categories, right? And I wonder if you could talk, one of them, I mean, we'll go over two or three of these. One of them is what you call revised and historical understandings of religion. Now, as you know, post-secular thought is sometimes accused by other scholars of being kind of fuzzy on the subject of religion. So my question is, how do you understand the post-secular engagement of religion? Like, what do you mean by revised and historical understandings of religion?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that the core of that thought, what I'm meaning, is to understand that religion is a category that is invented during early modernity in the West, maybe the late Middle Ages in the West. I mean, it's anachronistic. I think scholars of all kinds of stripes agree with this. Scholars of religion and of secularism, every single book you go to that tries to define religion starts out by telling you there's no thing in the ancient world, even in the medieval world, called religion the way we mean it today, right?
Yes.
Whereas it's the religious in distinction from some ostensibly secular space that is free of belief or uncertainty or faith.
Yeah, right. Good. So first of all, in the medieval world, religion is like water. It's the element in which fish swim. It's just, right? And the fish doesn't know it's in water. It's just living in the world, right? Yeah, so religion was water until suddenly it was different from land, right?
Yeah. I mean, like Wilfred Cantwell Smith, he brings up this great point. He's one of the old guys in the early part of the 20th century defining religion. And he even says, you know, back then, we scholars did not listen to it terribly well, that, you know, like it would have been it would have made no sense to an ancient Aztec any more than like a ancient Roman or Greek to say, is this act that you're doing religious or political,
right?
Worshiping this emperor or do no. I mean, that question would not have made sense because life was viewed and humanity was just viewed more integratedly than that. People, and we can't even say integratedly because the things hadn't been disintegrated such that they could be integrated again. It was just that you didn't separate those out. Like religion comprised, religio, I mean, there was this word, right? It comprised this larger sense of duty and relationship and religare, connectedness, reconnectedness, right? And so for me, like one of the foundational moments in post-secular studies is just to realize that the very concept of religion, the way we think of it today, has this history, that it gets invented during the late Middle Ages, the early modern period, alongside with a new concept that is birthed, is this idea of the secular. Right. And so it's religion and the secular, the way we think of them today, come into being at the same moment, just a dramatic moment of disaggregation of things, a separation, you know, and so many scholars that we have today are linking the birth of this secularization, the birth of the secular religious binary, to the birth of colonialism and empire around the globe. That, you know, we recognize that this division happens within Christianity in the West in the 15th, 16th century. Why does it happen? Because Christian people are dividing off their religion from this act of material appropriation around the globe. And I mean, that's really one of the stories. And so this idea of separating off the gospel and what it means to believe from what it means to live rightly in the world in a lot of ways, you know, it begins immediately to change Christianity and its own self-conception, right? I think we could say, I don't want to get too far into the weeds of that. I mean, I think that that's been a temptation of Christianity from the beginning. I mean, you know, that this making the friendship between the city of God and the city of the world, right? Just making friends with worldly power, and so downplaying the things, the way that the aspects of righteousness, some of the things, the way the Lord asks us to live in the world, right? And just kind of saying, well, this is the way of the world. We kind of have to let that go, that aspect of patriarchy or slavery or whatever it is. And so, I mean, the seed is there a long time, but this real division and this conceptualization of the religious in one sphere and the secular in the other, this is something that happens. And Charles Taylor wants to say around 1500. And so what's important for us modern believers, I feel like, in that question about, you know, the revision of religion, is to realize, first of all, that we have most likely, it would be a miracle if we had not internalized some very wrong ideas about what religion is, about what our own faith is, because we have been thinking our religion against and in terms of this idea of the secular. And so this is where the sword of the post-seculars, to be dramatic about it, you know, really does cut both ways. I mean, it has a lot to say. I think when I first began thinking about the post-secular, because I was a person of faith in a very secular academy, I was always thinking about, you know, how this is a critique of the secular, that it's the secular that's trying to keep the religious out of things. But the longer I go on with this, and as I near, you know, trying to write my real manifesto, but trying to come to the end of this book about the post-secular reason, the more that I just see, it seems like the religious end, the way that a really thoroughly post-secular thought troubles religious self-conceptions and modernity and post-modernity just becomes clearer and clearer and clearer to me. I mean, I'll stop there at that, but what are your thoughts about that?
Well, no, I think that's fascinating. I think that's really, really great. Here's a little anecdote. I remember when I was starting up a graduate school, right? And I come from a deeply religious background of my own. And I was at a you know, interested in as a grad student, in very so-called secular things, so-called. I remember one time, though, talking to another grad student a year or two further along than I was, and he was explaining to me, you know, kind of, yes, what I'd been working on, and I explained, you know, I'd been a master's student at NYU, had taken a class from Derrida for like a month, you know, he'd spend in New York City every year, and I said, well, you know, deconstruction, some questions. And he said, oh, yeah, right. He says, well, you know, we used to work on that kind of thing, and now we all work on something else. And I thought, you know, the way that the passion and the sense of totality, I thought, you know, there really is something, there's a deeply vested, almost religiosity, dogmatism to the way that he was talking about what we all do now. It struck me as being, if you are familiar with religious dynamics and how they are encompassing of the totality of life, that there was a religion happening right there, even though it wasn't named as such. I thought this was a very religious moment. What we do, why we do it, why we care. And it struck me that one thing I really appreciate about your work is that it does ask the question, okay, so what is secular here? We don't recognize as secular, but also what is religious that we might not understand is actually deeply religious in how we actually live. Whether we are cognizant of it or not, that we do things that draw on the dynamics, these, you know, religare, and these connectedness, the connectedness of religious belonging in all kinds of ways. So I asked you about the question, you know, that revised and historical understandings of religion. I think that's one of the really important things that you do. Let me ask you about one more. Does that make any sense?
It's
what
really
I said?
Confusing. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that when we start talking about, there's always this, I don't know, this Mobius strip moment when you start to critique the religion secular binary, and then you start to keep using the terms religious, and then somebody says, you're just reifying the religious, the very categories that you're trying to critique. You can't do that. But here's the thing. But that binary, when we start to think in that way, religion and secularism, we didn't just invent the things like commerce and trade on the one hand, or military exploits, war and empire. And we didn't just invent prayer, belief in God, right, acts of charity and corporeal mercy.
Right.
No, you know, those are all of those things are things in human life and the world. I mean, human existence on our planet. But we started to code them, you know, religious and secular, to separate them out like this. And so it's really important for us to, it does mean that we can still use those terms. We have to recognize that they're historically situated. And then we can, from a really, I think, a deeply and properly post-secular viewpoint, we can start to say, you know, this binary never works out in this clean-cut way that we wish it did, or that we hoped it, or that we thought that it did. And so, in fact, look, when we have this certain kind of academic discourse, there's something very confessional about it. There's something very, I love Michael Warner in his essay, That Uncritical Reading, where he's like, if we're going to inculcate the pieties of critical reason, we ought to at least admit that that's what they are. And that makes so much sense to me. So we can point out when we point out the religiousness of something in the academy that seems ostensibly secular, we're not undoing the critique of the secular religious binary. We're actually enacting that to say, see, like these are all of these aspects of human life are partaking of things that trouble this binary.
Great. Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, Lori. Another one of these categories that you raise that I find compelling is this category of the reality of the person. That's one of these seven sort of tenets of this manifesto. What do you mean by the reality of the person?
Yeah, you know, I have to say that the more that I'm going into this project, and the more that I keep thinking, I feel like I'm nearing kind of the end of the book length project, you know, the more that the crux of thinking in a post-secular way is really about thinking about the human being. I mean, when I guess to back up from it then is to say that what I think is wrong about the binary construction of the secular and the religious that emerges in modernity is that it fundamentally misunderstands human experience in human life, what it is to be a person. And what I mean by that is just that, you know, I think that the predominant modes of understanding what it is to be human that have been produced in I mean, since the early modern period and really in the heyday of the Enlightenment, they're fundamentally economic and materialist kinds of paradigms. You know, that homo economicus is a famous phrase, you know, that Marx, everyone is going to use from Robinson Crusoe forward, you know, to describe, like, we really imagine human beings as selfish, self-interested, isolated individuals who are predominantly concerned with exchange, profit, and gain. And, you know, and this is, I mean, certainly what person would deny that human beings engage in that kind of thinking and behavior, but by no stretch of the imagination is that the totality of who we are, right? So many of our ideas of the human being are essentially, you know, they're versions of what Charles Taylor calls subtraction theory. So when he talks about, like, secularization is a subtraction story where we say, oh, all this religious illusion and mythological belief, we peel it all away and we get down to some materialist immanent core of, you know, the really the secular world, what it is. And but there's a concomitant, you know, version of the production of the human that takes place in that. Oh, the literary, oh, the spiritual, oh, the religious, all of this. It's really, we have homo economicus, is that secular kernel of the human being. And we have different versions of that. I mean, such that even when we are trying to, you know, rehabilitate, I think, some of the more unseen aspects of what it is to be human, right? We come out with a product like affect theory, you know, mm-hmm. which has been having a heyday here for the last few years and in the humanities, right? And I think affect theory is fascinating. There's great things to come out of it. But at the bottom, it seems to me like it's fundamentally materialist in its orientation, right? It wants to say, oh yeah, literature has this profound human effect because it's more visceral than thoughts and ideas. Right. It's fundamentally material. And so wouldn't it just be, I'd like to expand the thought, right? To not wed our concept of the human being to this, what I really do think is a very reductively materialistic, naturalistic version. And like Marilynne Robinson, for instance, would encourage us to do, like, take on that, the whole history of our human conversations about what it is to be a human being, right? Which has, we have so much, you know, profound thought about the transcendent dimensions of the human person, its longings for transcendence, just its consciousness, the way our consciousness exceeds just our material reality. You know, that if we just think about, like, materially what our thoughts, how they seem to register in our brain as electromagnetic impulses, then they do. They clearly do. When I think certain thoughts, you can hook me up to a monitor and you can see my brain waves, like, making certain. But the experience of me thinking about my daughter's beautiful painting she made for me for my birthday of my favorite teacup, right? But my feelings, my thoughts, the experience of me seeing that painting, of thinking that thought, bears no resemblance whatsoever to that electromagnetic brainwave that's been traced, right? So my consciousness and my human experience is really truly of a different order. It happens together with that material reality, but it has so much else to it, right? And it's not illegitimate to talk about those things, to register the rest of that human conversation. In fact, what we really need to be doing is always thinking about the intersection of that immanent material existence with that transcendent. You know, it's religious thinkers ourselves, right? Who have so often wanted to separate off the dimension of the spiritual or the religious or the transcendent from the material. But what the real human religiousness, boy, it's a huge globalizing statement I'm making there, I realize I'm on thin ice, but is that human beings are constantly thinking about the paradoxical intersection of the immanent, the material, the calculable, the finite, with all of these things that seem to sacramentally, representationally point beyond that immanence toward what is the very ground of being. And that ground of our being seems to be something related to consciousness,
yeah.
You know, and we sense that when we think about our own human consciousness. And of course, I mean, we have human intuitions across every religion, from Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, to thinking about God or some kind of conscious being, right, as at the groundwork of this material universe, which is essentially mediating the relationships among these free and conscious beings. Sorry, that was woo. I just went off into the stratosphere on that. But so for me, that's, yes, I want us to open ourselves once again, you know, and anew, really, into this imagination of what the human person is, and how that relates to both materiality, immanence, the body, and the transcendent, the soul consciousness, on the other hand.
Lovely. Thank you very much. That was a very rich response to that question. Let's get one more of these categories and then take up kind of maybe a related but slightly different line of thought. You also mentioned that one thing that the post-secular does is it helps to renovate the big questions. Now, the big questions, you know, who am I? Why am I here? What happens to me as I die or after? I mean, these things are the big questions of our humanity. And I guess I have, one of my questions would be, you know, are you more drawn to how religion helps us answer these questions, or are you more drawn to how religion helps us ask them?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know. It's the easy way out is to waffle and say it's both, isn't it? I mean, yeah. There's just this long human history of posing these questions, the big questions of meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning, representation, like significance, which are always end up being questions of relationality. I guess I would just want to say both. That and that, you know, we can even with respecting all manner of possible positionalities in our, you know, global 21st century context, you know, we can use some secular language like Jürgen Habermas would, you know, to say like, there are religious resources, religious citizens have resources to bring to the table to offer as we consider questions that about meaning, about life, about the sanctity of life, all of these things, you know, that they can bring to the table. Now, I mean, there's problems with Habermas's configuration of that sometimes, I think, because he's always thinking that the religious interlocutor has to always be translating their thoughts into secular terms.
Right.
And so I think that there's some issues with that. And Talal Asad's relatively new book on secular translations is really important and good on that point. But I mean, the religious traditions of the world give us all kinds of vocabularies and not just vocabularies. Asad is again good on this, but ways of being in the world, rituals, practices that shape us as human beings, right? That make us able to sustain new and different ways of being in the world, of interacting with each other, new and different, you know, enable us to sustain generosity or sacrifice or modesty of living in the world, you know? And those are huge. I mean, when I think about the gaps in critical thought, I mean, what are the gaps of criticism and intellectual life as we've been practicing it? Oh, let's say even just since 1968 or something. I think that it's the gaps and like ways of living that produce subjects and persons that form spiritual beings who can live up to the ideals that we even want to have in the world. And I don't think that, you know, from a purely critical or purely naturalistic, materialistic basis, that we really ever get to those rich places of how am I shaping myself as a human being that religion and spirituality gets us to. And it has historically just been deeply concerned with. We have millennia of conversation about that. Why wouldn't we want to draw on that wisdom and follow that up and engage in that ourselves, you know, creatively in an ongoing way?
Right. No, wonderful. Thank you. I think it's very well said. I know that in my own case, a lot of I think the way that religion helps me pose these questions. I guess for one thing, before I ever had read Foucault, before I had ever read Derrida, you know, I was already invested in a tradition that talked about the importance of being able to sort of ask these large questions. And I found, you know, when I was, look, I was 19, 20 years old, I was a missionary in France and Switzerland, you know, and you're talking to people all the time about big questions. And I found then, that the reason why I went into pursue an education in literary studies, then I get a PhD, is it was a continuation kind of a spiritual odyssey that I was engaging in these large questions with people. And I had some semblance of answers, things I felt convicted about, you know, things I felt were true. But I also realized that the questions and the answers were also beyond me, and I wouldn't be able to understand them fully unless I understood, you know, the deep body of learning and not just my religious tradition and its theology. And so there was always this kind of rich layering of these two things together for me, such that for me, there's always been kind of a provisional sense to how I answer large questions, but coming at them from the standpoint of faith or belief, religion, really helps me understand that these are not just abstract questions that you're asking, but they really do shape how you live. They shape your character, your being. They have implications for others. And there's a sense of meaning or purpose involved in that, I think, when they're remembered for me as having a basis in my religious and not just my academic experience. This is a great conversation. I want to ask you a couple more things before time goes away completely from us in this podcast.
Okay.
Let me go back for a second to something you talked really richly a few minutes ago about the problem of the religious and secular binary, right? And you talk about the secularization thesis. And your point is that secularism is an ideology, that we overstate its meaning. We don't really understand what that is. Post-secular thought has been around now long enough, 20 years, you know, more or less. Would you say that there is a post-secularization thesis? Is there a sense that the post-secular is something? And would you say that it actually is the thing that it claims to be?
That's a really great question. And, you know, because you told me early on that you thought you wanted to call this episode, Are We Still Post-Secular? Were We Ever?
Yeah.
Are you still going with that title?
I thought
my answer to that question would have to be, we're getting there. But it's an ever incomplete process, right? Isn't that, I mean, that's one of the things that the scholars are always saying about secularization. You think about Vince Pecora's wonderful book, you know, Secularization Without End, right?
Yeah.
And he makes this great recognition from a very secular kind of vantage that secularization conceptually, like really, truly is a perpetually incomplete process. That's the dynamic by which it works. And I think that we can say something similar about, you know, the post-secular, which, you know, as everybody always says, myself included, it's a very imperfect term, but it does some important work for us in saying that we want to get past this binary division between the religious and the secular. I mean, for me, it flags that maneuver, first of all, right? But beyond that, that act of criticizing that binary, of wanting to deal differently with it, I'm really interested in thinking about pluralities of post-secularities. I mean, I'm not interested myself in a post-secularism, you know? I mean, I want us to critique that thought, but then to reshape the real materials of human existence that we formerly divided off into the religious on the one hand and the secular on the other. So it's my students, there's always this great moment for my graduate students. And now this makes me sad that maybe a couple of them who haven't had this experience yet, they're going to listen to this podcast and the cat's going to be out of the bag. There always comes this moment when they're like, when they tell me like, but what really is, you know, like the post-secular or the post-secular method. And there's that moment where I lean across the desk and I tell them, you are making it up.
Yeah.
Like you have to decide what that is. What I mean is like, we have this apparatus of critiquing that binary, but this is a properly religious, spiritual, constructive, positive. It's what takes us beyond critique and beyond, you know, like pure reason in some way. Like we're going to construct, how are we going to configure the human messy dealing with that intersection of the transcendent and the immanent? Like, how do we think about that? How do I want to see the way literature does that, or the literature that I'm interested in does that, or the art that I'm interested in does that? And so, yeah, I mean, I want to think of, are we post-secular? I mean, there's still so plenty in the academy. You know, people get their PhDs and they teach for a really long time and they make disciples. And so we have a lot, there's plenty of secularism still running around the academy and we have made some progress. I mean, I really do think, I think that post-secular reason is a thing now in the academy, you know, and that's a big accomplishment of the last 10 years or so, you know, it's just to have that word be used in academic settings. And there are grants and the institutes and book series and things that, you know, that signal on all sorts of intellectual levels that this critique of the secular religious binary is operative, but and so that's important. But there are dialogues that are still opening up. I mean, that need to be opened up, right? And that can be opened up in more effective ways as we continue to interact with just like the strange afterlife of secular ideologies. Mm-hmm. You know, in the academy, especially in all of our different critical isms. You know, and so, yeah, I see the post-secular as really engaged in this fundamentally positive and creative and, again, like person-based way. This is why it can be infinite in a sense, because infinitely generative, the post-secular, because each human being can have a different way of describing, of creating art, of creating intellectual work about this intersection of the transcendent and the immanent and their relationality. And we do still, I think, have this project of having to push back a little bit against the secular ways, the cordoning off of the religious from the secular that is still operating in all kinds of intellectual spheres.
Okay, good. Now, you mentioned, one of the phrases you mentioned was that phrase post-secular reason. That's one of the things, one of the accomplishments of the last 10 years is there's an identifiable kind of an intellectual integrity, a kind of a logic, you know, kind of the post-secular thought. Would you say, I don't know anybody who knows the field better than you do on this one, Lori, so I'm curious, if you think back to how the field's developed, has it developed the way you thought that it might? And has it developed to your satisfaction? I mean, you see all kinds of possibility in it, which is wonderful. And I see that along with you. And when you say to your students, you know, you're inventing, you know, the post-secular, what you're doing, the work you're doing in this class or in your work, you are creating the possibilities here that will become the basis for our post-secular thinking. And that's true. At the same time, there is a field. The field has kind of its own gravity, its own kinds of, you know, sort of laws and ecosystems. Do you find the field of the post-secular to be one that you think is habitable? Is it what you thought it was going to be when you were first looking at the field like 15 years ago or so, 20 years ago?
Yeah. You know, now I think I'm understanding this question the way that you're meaning it a lot better. And I would kind of take refuge in my idea that I'm not really so interested in the post-secular field. Like, it's in the same way that I'm, you know, kind of like shy of like any post-secularism, because really what I'm interested in is, I'm sorry to say, what I'm really concerned for us to do is to leaven the discourses of all kinds of scholarly inquiry such that they intellectual inquiry, whether it's in sociology of religion or it's in anthropology, it's in literature, it's in art history, whatever it's in, right, does not have this coercive or reductive materialism or naturalism about it, right, such that people's religious thoughts, identities are closeted, right, such that there's this whole swaths of history and human experience that are off the table, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really a kind of leavening. And that's why I feel like, for me, because I see post-secularity, the post-secularity I want is more like a sea change, right? Across intellectual endeavor in the humanities, is because I see it that way that I just feel like, oh, we've made some progress and there's so much more to do.
Yeah.
you know, and again, I don't, yeah, I guess I wouldn't want to, I don't know. I feel like if there's just like post-secular studies, there's probably utility to that. And I wouldn't like stop it. I've used that phrase myself at a book series title, right? Post-secular studies. And does I mean, what I mean by that is not that it's a separate field, but that it's something like when we're thinking about literature, religion, and secularism, post-secular studies of that whole amalgam, right? It can be part of our sensibility that we're bringing to those studies rather than just, I wouldn't want to see us be ghettoized, I guess, so to speak. And I use that term ghettoized very like intentionally. I just mean like, you know, like scholars of children's literature, which I also do scholarship on children's literature. You know, did a lot of talking in the early 2000s about the ghettoization of children's literature and how that happens in the academy and why, and what are the implications of it and how can we undo it? Right. And so that's what I mean. Like that, this kind of like, oh, post-secular, okay, we'll let it exist, but it's this kind of lesser thing, the secondary thing. When we, again, we're going to put kind of a fence around it and be, like you said, you know, kind of, it can be its echo chamber, have its own little conversations, you know? No, I mean, I would be, what would be my dream, my post-secular dream about the academy, right? Would just be that we came to see, like in my own field for literature studies, right? That when a department was hiring a position, a medievalist, an early modern specialist, somebody doing contemporary fiction, whatever they were hiring, right? That if they had, you know, really, you know, bright candidates doing interesting new work, and this kind of critique of the secular and the religious binary, or some kind of new awareness of the way like spirituality or spiritual practice or spiritual experience, to use like terms that are important for your really amazing, you know, contemporary work, to say how is that living in the artwork that I'm analyzing, in the literature that I'm analyzing, right? If a normal, I'm putting that in scare quotes, you can't see me on podcast land, but I'm using my scare quotes on Zoom.
Yeah, I see it on Zoom, yes.
Normal, quote, secular, again, scare quote, you know, like university setting. If we just recognize that as like legitimate inquiry in the humanities that had something to say outside of some kind of, quote, ghettoized, you know, discussion, then I'd be really happy. You know, I'd feel like we had really made some progress in like recognizing, as long as we need to keep putting some kind of safety fence around the scary idea of the religious or the spiritual or the conscious, the transcendent or whatever, right? Once we quit making that fence, I think I'd be happy, because I just feel like we'd be having a more authentically human conversation, authentic to the past of human conversations about what it is to be human, and authentic to the future, what we might become. I mean, where we want this adventure of human life on this earth to go.
That's lovely. That's lovely. As I asked you at the beginning of our conversation today about faith, and one of the things that faith means to me, and I'm connecting this now to what you just said. One thing that it means to me, it's the facet of life that makes everything more meaningful, that makes life fuller, right? Mm. Makes my experience fuller, makes my relationships fuller. And that kind of, that authentic human experience you're talking about, right? Human in its full dimensions. That's something that your work, and your very humanity, Gloria, does that. You're great. Yeah, you're such a great friend and scholar. It's such a pleasure to talk with you today about this. Thank you so much for taking the time to meet and to have this conversation in this podcast.
Well, likewise, I can say all that back to you, Matt. And I just, it's a testament to what a great interlocutor that you are, that I just feel like we could just sit here and talk.
Much
longer.
I
have a very big mug of herbal tea here, and we could just sit here and talk for the rest of the afternoon.
Right, we could.
I'd be totally happy
Very
with
happily.
That.
I would do that
but,
anytime.
Yeah,
yes.
The time flies when you're having a great conversation with such a good person and dear friend. So,
thank you, Lori. Best of luck to you this semester, and we'll talk soon.
Likewise, you too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Sam Jacob. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you're interested in other episodes of this podcast or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.